He scans them with his flashlight. "Nothing," he says to the other man. The light goes back in my eyes. "You have fed?" "Would that be good news or bad news for you?" "Did he have a PI license?" asks the other man. "Nope." "Then I say we work his ass over." "Stop!" William shouts from the other side of the street. "Let him go!" "You know this mouthy asshole?" asks the guard.
"Yeah, he's with me."
"Does Mathis know?" William comes running over to me. "Yes, yes, he wants to talk to him. Theo, I'm sorry, I didn't, remember that I told you to meet me here." He knows I followed him, but he doesn't want them knowing that. I don't know if that's for his benefit or mine. "Come on," he says. "Let's go inside, so you can meet Justice Mathis." Chapter 14. Public Enemy. Detective Corman's public enemy number one is drinking a smart water on the other side of a coffee table with a James Turrell art exhibition book resting on it, as his teenage daughter sits in the kitchen with her grandmother, working on her AP European history homework. Athletic, dressed in a form-fitting black sweater, he could be a wealthy attorney or an on-the-rise politician. It's hard to reconcile a man whose enunciations are more pronounced than my overly educated ones with a South Central gangbanger who ruthlessly killed his way to the top. But I don't doubt it for a millisecond. Mathis is intelligent, watchful, and one of the most charismatic people I've ever met. You hear how some people swooned when Bill Clinton entered a room, or Brad Pitt flashes a smile. Mathis has that kind of charm. So did Ted Bundy. So did Joe Vick, from what people described, although my altercation with him was less than charming. That's not to say that I think Mathis had anything to do with Chris's disappearance, but I think it explains his ascendancy to power and why a guy like Detective Corman is infuriated that this man is sitting here in a multi-million dollar home prepping his daughter for the Ivy League. "First off, Professor Cray, please don't pay the fellas outside any mind. I still have some enemies from my rowdier days." Rowdier days? That's how he spins it? "I hope they don't look like me." "You might be surprised. Some boys watch a little too much Sons of Anarchy and get some idea in their head." I vaguely remember that being a television show about a gang of white bikers. Could that really be what his welcoming committee thought I was? If so, then it doesn't exactly make it look like Mathis's rowdy days are all that far behind him. "Second," says Mathis, "I want to thank you for helping William out. He's like a brother to me, and the loss of Christopher..." "Well, it was like losing one of my own." Was it? How much effort did Mathis put into finding him? Or did he do anything at all? "I'm not sure how much help I can be, but William's, or rather Christopher's situation, seems rather frustrating."
"Yes."
He nods sympathetically.
"William says you were at the LAPD going through records about Chris's disappearance. Did you find out anything?"
"Loads. But maybe I don't need to share everything."
"Yeah, it looks like it was a half-assed investigation."
I turn to William. "I even spoke to the investigating detective."
"Corman?"
"Yeah, that's the one.
He stopped taking my calls years ago."
"I think he gave up." Suddenly, I'm not sure what else I should say.
"Did he blame me?" asks Mathis. "Did he say this happened to Chris because his daddy was in with a gangster?"
"Well, that was on the nose."
"In a roundabout way."
"Did he lay out a file and tell you I was the Al Capone of Compton?"
I got more of a Pablo Escobar impression.
Mathis nods, then turns to William.
"How many times have we been audited?"
9 times, he replies.
"None ever successfully prosecuted."
"And how many times have we been raided?"
5 times.
"And did they ever make a case?"
"Yes, once."
Mathis's face changes.
"What?"
"Health violation.
Your cousin Stacy was putting raw meat on the prep counter. They shut us down.
Mathis raises his hands in mock protest.
Well, then I guess I'm guilty of hiring my idiot cousin to run a burger joint she wasn't qualified to operate.
I smile. It's a great show. I bet he's done it for politicians, celebrity friends, and his rich friends at Soho House when the subject comes up.
I buy the innocence bit even less, because he's let me know how smart he is. Of course cops used to busting dumbasses who never graduated high school aren't going to have an easy time getting a guy like Mathis.
Maybe he's done, maybe he's not, but I'm pretty sure he's pretty far removed from all that right now, and never touches something outside his lawyer's office.
I learned everything I needed to know when the thug outside took my photo and told the guard I wasn't a cop. Anyone clever enough to have a database of police officer headshots is already too many steps ahead. None of that matters to me. What I need to know is if he was involved in Chris's abduction. Corman and the LAPD can worry about everything else.
I was doing some research, I tell Mathis, and I came across a statistic that said most kidnappings go unreported because they're drug-related. Corman suggested that maybe one of your rivals took Christopher. Maybe to get to William. Maybe to rattle you.
Mathis's voice lowers. Do I look like I rattle?
Let me ask you a question. Why are you here?
He raises a large hand before I can respond.
I don't mean helping William. I mean, why are you talking to me instead of dead back somewhere in Montana?
He's clearly been talking to William. The real reason? Because that asshole took someone I cared about.
Some 7-foot hillbilly giant who killed 7 cops was about to hurt someone you loved. So you ended him. What do you think a so-called gangster like me would do if somebody tried to rattle me or go after someone close to me? You think that wouldn't be in the papers the next day?
I see your point. Unless you did it.
Me?
He stares at William incredulously.
Why me?
Why isn't Chris's mom here?
I can see Mathis's neck muscles tighten and hear the sound of William inhaling.
Mathis locks eyes with me, but doesn't say a thing.
That had nothing to do with Mathis, pleads William. Nothing. Why would you bring that up? You can't say stuff like that.
That's low, man. Real low, Mathis finally replies.
I may be on a one-way trip to one of his chop shop incinerators, but I need one more reaction to confirm my theory. What did the papers say the day after she and the other two people got killed? Which of your enemies did you smite?
There's a long, uncomfortable pause. Finally, he replies,
retributions were made.
Fuck. He killed her, and William knows this. I catch the pained look on Bostrom's face out of the corner of my eye. I take a deep breath.
Let me be clear. I'm not a cop. I'm a scientist. I find patterns. William showed up on my doorstep because he wanted me to find out what happened to his son. That's all I care about. I want to know who took the kid. I want to know if the man who did it is still out there.
Mathis's gaze intensifies as he reads my face. He nods, then holds out his hand for me to shake.
And I want you to find him.
Chapter 15. Father Figure. William is sitting across from me in a booth at a bar where I'm pretty sure I'm the only white face, but nobody could give a damn.
Brenda and I were pretty messed up back then. I was using. She was using. It's a miracle Chris was such a good kid. That boy raised himself. And then,
I raise a hand. No offense, but I don't need or care to know what happened to your wife if it doesn't relate to Chris's disappearance.
William has a hurt look on his face. He wants to confess something to me. He wants me to try to understand. There's only one problem. I'm pretty sure there's no version of the story I would believe in which he didn't look bad.
I just wanted to say that Mathis... I cut him off. Mathis is a special kind of sociopath.
You don't know him. He's a great guy. He's funded community centers. He'd give you the shirt off his back, unless you took it from him.
Look, you can convince yourself all you want, but you know what he is. One minute he's Father of the Year, the next he's making someone an orphan.
You don't know what it's like to grow up out here.
I don't, but neither does he. Mathis came from money. He came here because he knew he could get away with the evil things he wanted to do a little more openly.
William shakes his head.
You judgmental... I haven't judged anyone. Have I said something that isn't true? Mathis isn't like you or me. He's a particular kind of sociopath, the kind that makes a great politician. He makes you think he loves you until you stand in his way. And then when he does something to fuck you over, he makes you think it's your fault.
And you know this from experience?
I've spent a lot of time this last year trying to understand those kinds of minds. There are even genes that correlate with charisma. Some of them overcompensate for a lack of internal empathy. They make you feel like they care more than anyone else, while you're nothing to them.
So it's all just genes to you?
No, not always. I think you can teach yourself that, too.
Like you can convince yourself it's okay to continue working for your wife's murderer.
William nods slightly.
But you don't think he had anything to do with Chris?
I don't think so. Not directly.
What does that mean?
With Joe Vick, there was a pattern to his victims. Many of them were girls on their own with drug problems.
Like Lonnie Franklin, the Grim Sleeper?
Yeah, easy prey.
William crosses his arms defensively.
And my son was easy prey?
I don't know any other way to put it.
Christopher's father worked for a reputed drug kingpin who was rumored to have murdered his mother for revenge. In the cops' eyes, you guys were tainted. They did the bare minimum to find out what happened to Chris because they were pretty sure he was already ashes in one of Mathis's furnaces. They knew they'd never be able to prove it, so they didn't bother looking.
You're one cold motherfucker. At least Mathis doesn't make you feel like shit.
That's so you don't see the knife coming. I'm honest. I never met your kid, but everything you told me about him makes me like him. I lost someone who was closer to me than I realized. I didn't go after Vic because he threatened someone I loved. I went after him because he took someone from me I never even got to know. I understand guilt. I know pain. The only antidote I have is brutal honesty.
William starts to speak, but I raise a hand to stop him.
I can lie to you and pretend that your past doesn't matter. But it does. You and I both know that you and your wife were playing with fire. I have no judgment on what happened. It's not my place to forgive you or make you feel guilty. The only monster I'm concerned about is the one that took Christopher. Not just because of what he did, but because of what he might be doing.
You think he's still out there?
I nod. Why would he stop? He figured out how to get the cops to not care. That's where I look next. For some reason, Corman gave me a stack of missing kid folders. I suspect he knows there's something out there. I also suspect he thinks he's still out there because he discovered Corman and the other cops' blind spot.
Families like ours.
Yep. Invisibles.
William takes a long sip of beer and watches me.
You're still judging me.
I'm going to help you find out what happened to your boy. Does it matter what I think?
William shakes his head.
What I'm saying is, Mathis is smart, real smart. He could help us. All we have to do is ask.
Personally speaking, I plan on staying as far away from him as possible.
So you think you see through all that charm?
No, I don't. That's the problem. My gut says to like him. The rational part of my brain tells me to pay attention to the obvious. Your boss is a crook, and I'm a crook, he puts in.
But not a child killer. I tip my bottle toward his.
Let's finish up and go find one.
Chapter 16. Outreach. Corman's files aren't just a random collection of missing children reports. They're the hard cases, the ones where it was difficult to gather any evidence because the kids came from broken homes. In some cases, when the police went back to get more information, the families had left in a hurry. At least half of the files were from households that appeared to be filled with illegal aliens. I get a chill thinking about how many cases of abducted children go unreported because the families are too afraid to talk to the authorities. I can't even fathom what kind of nightmare it is to be too afraid to go to the police in a situation like that. When I put the data into pre-docs, I get a purple band stretching across a map of the city, indicating areas where a predator might be at work. I could have gotten the same map if I pulled up the records for where people buy prepaid phones and long-distance calling cards to Mexico, Central America, and South America. I decide to start with the point closest to where Christopher went missing and work my way outward. A year ago, the grandmother of Ryan Perkins reported him missing to the police. He left an after-school care program and never made it home. The police report mentioned that his father was at large and there had been custody issues. A follow-up report from Corman pointed out that the father was in county jail in Henderson, Nevada, at the time of abduction, suggesting that it might not have been so simple. A pleasant older black woman greets me when I step inside the community center. She's laying coloring books out on tables for when the kids arrive.
"Hello, young man. May I help you?"
"Hi, I'm Theo Cray. I'm doing some background work on some missing children cases." Her face turns sad.
"Oh, dear. Is this about LaTroy?"
"LaTroy?" I check the name on my note. "Who's LaTroy?"
"He went missing 3 weeks ago. I called his house and nobody answered. When I spoke to the police, they said his mother had been arrested. But his grandmother had no idea where LaTroy was. She thought maybe child services got him."
Jesus Christ. What a mess. "Actually, I'm here about Ryan Perkins."
"Ryan Perkins?"
I show her the photo of the boy. It was taken from a distance, so his eyes are red and his features hard to make out.
"Oh, yes, him. Didn't he go off with his father?"
"It would appear not."
"My."
She puts a hand to her heart.
"We get so many in and out of here, it's hard to keep track."
No kidding. Two missing kids in one aftercare program for disadvantaged kids. I think I'd rather send mine out on the street. Easy there, Theo. The whole reason this place exists is because of the broken homes these kids fall in and out of. This lady is doing her best to give them a stable environment. "Can you tell me anything about either of the boys? Did they know each other?"
"Oh, no. LaTroy Edmonds had only been here a week or two. Talented boy, though. Wonderful artist. Very pleasant."
She walks over to a cabinet and unlocks it.
"He left this behind, which struck me as odd. It was his favorite thing. He wanted me to hold on to it for safekeeping. It seems his mother had a habit of selling his things."
She hands me an Iron Man action figure. It's well used. I take a couple of photos, then hand it back to her. "Was there anything else you remember about LaTroy? Did anyone ever pick him up besides his mother or grandmother?"
"No. This is a walk-in program, so we don't have the same kind of control over the children as a school does."
"What about Ryan Perkins?"
"I don't think so either. I try my best to keep track of them."
"I'm sure you do. Kids are lucky to have someone like you looking after them." I look around the colorful room, and my eyes fall upon the back wall filled with children's drawings. I walk over to have a closer look. There's the typical illustrations of crudely drawn superheroes, lots of green for the Hulk, giant robots, and loving renditions of dogs and cats. A number of them show idealized versions of family life with everyone holding hands. One drawing stands out among all the rest. It's an all-black figure with a bag of toys. It reminds me of a bizarro Santa Claus,
I lean in for a closer look.
"Oh, you know LaTroy's work," says the woman.
"Pardon me?"
"LaTroy drew that. It's a little urban legend. I guess you'd call it that."
"What urban legend is that?"
"The toy man. He's supposed to drive a big Cadillac around and give toys to the good boys and girls."
"That sounds pleasant enough."
"Yes, it does. I wouldn't let LaTroy put the other drawing up."
"Why is that?"
"It was disturbing. It shows what the toy man does to the bad boys and girls."
I don't know how long I stood there before she asked me if I needed help.
Chapter 17. Signal. The assistant principal of Garvin Elementary School guides me down the hall and points to the school library.
"We have a wonderful tutoring program here. Kids from UCLA come in and work with the children on their homework."
"That's great," I reply, peering into the library and pretending to be interested. Children sit around tables as a teacher reads to them from a book. Ms. Dawson is a nice woman, proud of her school and the impact they have on students coming from challenging backgrounds.
"You said your daughter is in the fourth grade? Transferring mid-year can be difficult, but we handle a lot of transient students here. She'll be able to make friends quickly."
"I hope so. Gracie has had some difficulties. Nothing behavioral." Dawson nods, understanding that I'm telling her my imaginary daughter might be a problem learner.
"Let me show you our Achievers program. We're able to help kids get fast-tracked into a regular curriculum."
We head down another hallway, passing more classrooms. I peek through the windows, looking for drawings like the one in the aftercare program. Most appear to be schoolwork-related, none resembling the free-form art I saw before. My hope was that a school that focused on first-generation immigrant children and served problem learners might be a vector for more toy man drawings. It's a real long shot, but the fact that LaTroy, a kid who hadn't even made it into Corman's files, was making such creepy drawings has my curiosity piqued. If the children weren't abducted by a complete stranger, then it may have been someone who knew them or interacted with them prior to their abduction. The way in which these kids were targeted suggests that he had some knowledge about their family life. One way to find that out is to ask. Another is to have access to their records, which might reveal that he works in one of the schools or public services that look after children. It sounds paranoid, but Ted Bundy worked next to a former police officer at a crisis hotline who described him as kind and empathetic. This is the same man who in one night attacked 5 separate women, killing 2 of them. The school district here has had no shortage of monsters preying upon students. The scary part is that several of them, teachers who abused and molested their students, had complaints going back decades. The most egregious involved a teacher whose students were primarily the children of illegal aliens, too afraid to say anything. Besides having a large number of potentially at-risk children, Garvin is where LaTroy went to school. I want to find out if any of his classmates also had experiences with the toy man.
"Here's our Achievers class," says Dawson. "It looks like Mrs. Valdez has taken the kids to the activity field."
At the back of the room is a wall full of drawings, too far away for me to see in detail. "Can I take a look?"
Sure.
Dawson holds open the door for me. I catch a slightly suspicious look in her eye.
"What did you say the name of your company was, Mr. Gray?"
"I didn't. I work from home. I'm a software analyst. I couldn't exactly walk into the head office and tell them I was some concerned citizen who wanted to inspect their school for evidence of a fourth-grade Freddy Krueger."
"Right. And what does Mrs. Gray do?"
"She's a waitress," I reply, as I make a beeline through the tiny tables and chairs toward the drawings in the back of the classroom. There's the same collection of animals, families, and things kids see on television. Dawson is trying to figure me out as I scrutinize the pictures. I get the sense she's suddenly afraid that I'm not who I say I am.
"I have to take a phone call. We should be heading back to the office."
"Of course. I don't move. I'm trying to process the kid's sketches. They're a little abstract. Far to one side, I see a slender man in black with a bag of toys. I point it out to her. Do you know what this is? The name at the bottom says Rico, not LaTroy. She bends down for a closer look.
A black Santa Claus?
One of my daughter's friends mentioned something about the toy man. Have you heard that?
No. I think we should be going.
Of course. Let me text her mom and ask. I pull out my phone and take a photo.
Mr. Gray, I can't allow you to take photos in here.
I'm sorry. I drop my phone to my side and spot the teacher's open planner on her desk. Let's get you back to the office. She turns to the door, and I head straight to the desk.
Mr. Gray?
I need to spit out my gum. With my back to her, I take a photo of all the student names.
All right, I'm calling school security.
She's got the walkie-talkie from her hip at her mouth in the blink of an eye. Great. I stare her down. Ask them what happened to LaTroy. She freezes.
Pardon me?
LaTroy Edmonds. He went missing a month ago. I point to the drawing on the wall in the back. He was drawing pictures of the toy man, too.
I have no idea what you're talking about. You need to leave before I call the police.
I raise my hands in surrender. I'm here to help.
Did anybody ask you to?
The father of another missing child. She's trying to decide how to wrap her head around what I said. On one hand, I've acted like a suspicious asshole. On the other, I'm talking about missing children and parents trying to find out what happened. Finally, she says,
If you have any questions, then you need to take them up with our principal. In the meantime, I have to ask you to leave our campus.
It's a tense walk back to my car as she follows me closely, trying to decide if I'm a threat or just some lunatic she let wander around the school. It's a valid question, one that I'm not sure even I can answer. Chapter 18. Emergency Contact. Deciding how far I'm willing to go to track down the origins of the toy man means deciding how far out of bounds I'm willing to step. Right now, I only have two drawings, one from a missing kid, the other from a child who is presumably not missing. I haven't asked William yet, because I want to make sure that I'm not going to send his already stressed mind down another blind alley. Tracking down the artist behind the second drawing, fourth grader Rico Caldwell, may be more difficult than getting the LAPD records. I can't exactly call up Ms. Dawson at the elementary school and ask if she'll give me Rico's home address. Standing outside the school when class lets out and yelling, "Rico!" as the kids get onto their school buses isn't exactly a great idea either. One option is to use a piece of phishing software, pretending to be the district IT department and calling someone in the school office and instructing them to click on something, a criminal tactic with a frightening success rate. The problem with that approach is that it's a federal crime. I'd rather find an approach that won't have me doing time. There's another approach that's risky in its own right, but could get me an answer in hours, although it would be slightly more hazardous to my health. One of the side benefits of consulting for intelligence agencies is that you get access to all kinds of interesting workshops. I took one on social engineering because my own natural skills were non-existent. Besides learning the typical ways that nefarious people can convince you to load virus software or talk their way through to the head of a company, I learned a remarkably easy way to get access to secure buildings. After parking my car down the street, I walk around the back of the LA Unified School District Administration Building until I identify the area at the edge of the parking lot that's the highest point of vulnerability, where people go to take their smoke breaks. I see two women and a man dressed in semi-casual business attire, all three puffing away under a tree the appropriate distance away from the building, according to California code. With my ID on my hip, but accidentally facing in, I pull my just-bought pack of Camels out, give them a friendly nod, and light up as I join them.
"Look, a new guy," says the man. He's Hispanic and about my height,
with a full head of hair and a cheery expression. I figure this is where the bad kids hang out.
I'm Corinne, says the black woman to my left, giving me a polite nod. This is Jackie and Raoul,
she indicates the other black woman.
Who the hell are you?
She asks with a smile. Jeff, here from the governor's office for a meeting that I've been in for 2 hours and still couldn't tell you what it's about.
Sacramento?
Asks Jackie. And Los Angeles. I commute.
More importantly, says Corinne, single? Straight? We're suffering a Y-chromosome shortage around here.
Divorced. Adjusting to single life. The women look at each other and share a smile as they both say,
Pauline.
Oh, buddy, Raoul sighs. You have no idea what you just walked into.
Likewise. I carry on for the next 10 minutes with my newfound friends, feeling slightly dirty. When it's time to stub out our cigarettes and head back inside, I start a conversation with Corinne as Raoul swipes his badge on the sensor and lets us all through.
Do you remember where you're headed?
Asks Raoul as we make our way to a bank of elevators. The conference room with all the sleeping people?
Floor 2. You'll have to take your pick, he says as we step into the elevator.
As I get off on the next floor, Corinne points to me.
Stop by the 4th floor afterward. We have someone we want you to meet.
Raoul rolls his eyes as the doors close. And, just like that, I'm inside the school district's administration building and have a prospective date. All because I signaled to a group of people ostracized for a particular habit that I am one of them. The hardest part was not coughing as I pretended to smoke. Although I'm in a building full of records, my goal isn't to try to get access to a computer or riffle through their files. What I actually need is an open phone. I walk down the hallway, looking through the windows of conference rooms until I find a small, unused one. I drop down into a chair, spread out some papers from a folder I brought with me, and make it look like I own the place. Satisfied that nobody is about to boot me, I pick up the phone and call Garvin Elementary, hoping that Ms. Dawson won't be the one to pick up.
Garvin Elementary, how may I direct your call?
Hello, this is Showalter from Unified Records. We're trying to process a parent emergency contact form from one of your students and having trouble reading it. I was wondering if someone there can clarify the information.
I can do that. What's the name?
Rico Caldwell.
Okay. I can't give you that information over the phone, but I can clarify it for you if you want to read what you have.
I was expecting this. Unfortunately, the image is too pixelated, but I can give you my extension here if you want to confirm.
That will work as long as it's at the 818-434 number.
I checked the number on the phone. Yes, extension 3874. Just ask for Showalter if I don't pick up.
It should only take a second.
Actually, it takes 12.
Showalter, I answer.
Sorry about that. Sometimes they check to make sure we're not giving out student information. I think we already had a call about Rico. Is everything okay?
Yes, I think so. Do you know who called?
3 days ago, someone from his pediatrician's office called, but they didn't leave a return number.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder if someone was circling Rico.
Have a pen?
She asks, and then gives me Rico's home address, the name of his mother, and everything else on the contact form. I thank her, and then get out of the building as quickly as possible. While following up with Corinne and company on the 4th floor could make future access easier, it also runs the risk of them mentioning the guy from the governor's office to somebody who knows better. While the chances are almost zero that anyone would care, they're not non-zero. And more importantly, I need to make sure that Rico isn't in harm's way. Chapter 19. Outreach. Rico lives in an apartment complex called Lincoln Gardens, a string of two-story yellow buildings with chipped paint surrounding a park, showing more brown than green. Black kids are bouncing a basketball around, while Hispanic teens chase a soccer ball out in the spotty field, reinforcing every stereotype already in my head. Mothers stand outside trading gossip, while men lean on cars talking to one another in Spanish and English. Rico's apartment is toward the back of the complex, and I make my way there, never getting as much as a second glance from anyone. I can hear a television set blaring through an open door on the second floor. When I get to the top of the steps, there's a little girl, maybe 2 or 3, playing with a broken doll and a saucepan lid. Inside are 2 teenage boys, both around 13, draped over the couch, watching a movie involving cars racing through streets. I knock on the open door. Hello? The boys glance at me for a moment, then turn back to their television. Is your mother home? I ask. One of them shouts,
Vete, gringo tonto!
I shout back at him,
Bájate del sofá, cucaracha perezosa!
This gets his attention, but only enough to flip me off. I knock on the door again, hoping to get the attention of an adult. Frustrated that he can't hear the sound of the cars revving, the brat yells into the other room,
Abuela! Hay un maricón en la puerta!
An old woman no more than 5 feet tall comes waddling toward the door in a house coat.
¿Qué?
She says, looking up at me. I show her my ID, hoping it conveys some kind of token of credibility.
¿Dónde está Rico?
The woman shouts into the house,
Rico! Rico!
A small boy wanders into the room and stares at me skeptically. Wearing only a pair of shorts, he looks a little too skinny for his age.
Rico?
I ask. The boy nods.
¿Hablas inglés? Yes.
He gives me a wary look, then steps closer, still under the protection of his grandmother. I kneel so I can be eye to eye and get a friendly smile from the little girl who had been playing at my feet. I pull the printout I made of his drawing out of my pocket and unfold it.
Did you draw this?
He stares at it for a moment, not sure if I'm going to get him in trouble.
It's fine. I just wanted to know.
The 2 teens from the couch have suddenly become interested and crowd the doorway behind Rico.
Yes, says Rico.
Do you know who that is? He nods.
What's his name?
Suddenly there's fear in the boy's eyes. Not at the drawing, not at my question, but of me. He runs through the others and back into the house. The 2 teens start laughing.
Hombre del juguete is going to get you!
One of them yells at him in broken English. I stand up. You know who this is?
Sí,
says the other.
Toy man. Everybody knows who he is.
Have you seen him?
Sí,
he says, stealing a glance at the other boy.
Where? Guzman Park. He's there all the time.
White man?
No,
he shakes his head.
El negro.
Do you know when he'll be there?
He's there right now.
There's an earnestness in the way that he replies without even conferring with his friend that tells me he's certain of that. Everything else I'm not so sure about. While I'd like to press little Rico for more answers, I get the feeling he's in no mood to talk to me. The kid went white as a sheet when I brought up the toy man. His older friends thought it was a joke, but seem very convinced of where he is. Thank you. I give their confused grandmother a smile. The little girl waves to me as I walk back down the steps. Walking away, I can feel the eyes of the teens on me as they watch from the balcony at the top of the stairs. Something is up, but I can't quite figure out what. Guzman Park is a 2-minute drive away. It's between Lincoln Gardens and Rico's school, and a likely spot Rico would pass every day if he didn't take the bus. I park my car and walk around the park, trying to act like I'm just out for a stroll. Kids are playing on the basketball court, while a group of teen girls sit on a concrete bench, chatting with one another. I see at least 2 families pushing strollers and holding hands with their ambulatory children. It's a pleasant evening, and everyone seems to be enjoying themselves. There's a group of young men off to the side, smoking some pot, and 2 others standing near a corner, engaged in what looks like some kind of illicit commercial transaction that everyone else is ignoring. I don't spot a white Cadillac or a black man dressed in dark clothes with a sack of toys. Not that I was expecting exactly that. I finish walking around the perimeter and take the path into the park that reaches a small circle of benches in the middle. Sitting there, I watch for anything suspicious. I'm starting to feel had when I hear the sound of footsteps on grass behind me. When I look over my shoulder, I see Detective Corman striding toward me. Chapter 20. Missing Connections.
I hear you're thinking about moving your family out here, he says sarcastically as he takes a seat next to me. I would, but you have a reputation for losing track of children, I reply. The problem is that when people find whoever was missing, they don't always tell us.
Is that the problem? I ask. Or is it that when someone goes missing, they don't tell you?
Can't help them if they don't ask.
What about LaTroy Edmonds?
Who's that?
A lady at the aftercare program says he went missing.
If we had to file a report for every kid that left with their parents back to Juarez or off to Nevada without telling anyone, I could build a border wall with the paperwork.
What about Ryan Perkins? Are his parents heading back to Mexico?
Corman shrugs. Probably not. Maybe Atlanta, maybe Houston. Who knows? Hard to keep track. People want a police state without the police. So what brings you out here? Looking for a place to take your kid?
I had a look at those files you gave me.
I was hoping you'd read those on the plane back to Texas.
I'm more of a field researcher. Anyway, I have a theory, but I suspect I'm not the first one to have it.
And what's that? Asks Corman.
That there's an active serial killer in the Los Angeles area.
Well, there's a shocker, he says dryly.
More specifically, one that targets at-risk children. Someone who moves around, not a lot, but maybe a few miles away every couple of years to break up a localized pattern. Maybe changes the demographic of his victims a little, but not by much. He seems to focus on young boys.
He folds his arms and tilts his head. Intriguing. You picked all this up from the files?
Well, it wasn't explicitly in there, but I could see how an LAPD detective with little more than this would be in a bind. Of course, the problem is that even he doesn't want to see what's out there. Maybe he hastily draws some conclusions on a few cases, writing them off, and then a few years later has some regret.
Well, that sure as hell isn't me, says Corman. I gave you those files because there might be something in some of those cases. But I assure you, the vast majority have very boring explanations or tragic ones we already know the answer to.
Maybe so, but there's one connection that might link them. I hand him a printout of Ryan Perkins's and Rico's drawings. Our missing kid made this, and a classmate of LaTroy's drew the other. Corman takes the pictures and stares at them for a moment, then chuckles.
The toy man.
You know the story?
Yes. He's Compton's Freddy Krueger. Or what is it my sons talk about? Slender Man.
He hands them back to me.
I've heard the stories. Is that why you're here? You're staking out an urban legend? Should we get the Mythbusters guys out of retirement?
I put the drawings back into my pocket. I know. Pretty silly. But here's the thing. I did an internet search for the toy man. I've got some pretty useful tools that let me do deep searches into social media and that kind of thing.
What did you find?
Basically nothing. There's only a handful of mentions. He waves to the park.
And yet you're out here trying to get the drop on an imaginary character.
While this stakeout may be a bust, my research turned up one very interesting bit of data. The mention of the toy man only came up in this area. All those files you gave me are within the range of the meme, which strikes me as kind of odd. If it's just a story and nothing more, it seems like we'd also be hearing about it in places without missing children.
Have you asked Bostrom if his son saw the toy man? Asks Corman.
Not yet. I wanted to see if it was more than a neighborhood legend. Does it even go back that far? I don't know. Like I said, there's hardly any online footprint. Plus the fact that it's an elementary school story, and they're not the most prolific tweeters. Especially these kids. Corman gets up and checks his watch.
Well, good luck on that. It's something to think about on your flight home.
Is the sheriff kicking me out of town? I reply as I stand as well.
I don't know about the sheriff, but this cop says that if I find you've been on school property again under false pretenses, you'll be able to talk to some suspects firsthand at the L.A. County Jail.
You're not bothered by the toy man connection? Two kids, maybe one is really missing, make a drawing of a boogeyman?
No, I'm not bothered. That's less than circumstantial.
Ever hear of John Butkovich? His parents called the cops over 100 times, asking them to look into a man they suspected killed their son.
Let me guess, that man killed him.
Yep, and at least 30 or 40 others that we know about. But even John Wayne Gacy lost track.
He groans. Well, I promise you, if someone calls me about a killer clown on the loose, I'll take it seriously.
Would you? I take out the drawings and hold them up. What if these kids are calling?
Good night, Dr. Cray. Have a nice trip home. I'll let you know if the toy man says hello.
I stare past him as a car's headlights illuminate something I hadn't noticed before. I was too busy staring into the park to see what was right there.
You okay there?
I point to something past his shoulder. The little fuckers weren't lying to me after all. Chapter 21. Tagged. I press my face up to the metal bars blocking the backside of an air conditioning repair shop that doesn't look like it's seen any business since the start of the last ice age. A collage of graffiti with 1,000 different co-creators stretches across the wall, but in the middle of them, seemingly given a certain amount of reverence for the artistry displayed, is a figure of a man with a dark suit and a void with red eyes and a sinister smile where a face would be. At his feet are the severed limbs of children scattered among bloody dolls and action figures. He looks almost as if he's stepping through the wall into reality. A caption above his head says, "The Toy Man is watching." It's a sinister nightmare that clearly means something to the artist. I take several photos while Corman looks on, unimpressed.
"Do you think a 9-year-old made this?" I ask.
"I think that was made about 10 years ago. Have you considered the notion that maybe this little nightmare is what started all the other kids talking?"
"Maybe." I take my phone out and call William.
"Hey, Theo, how are things going?"
"A quick question." I try to play it nonchalantly. "Did Chris ever mention anything about an urban legend involving someone called the Toy Man?"
"No, I don't think so. Why?"
I feel a sinking feeling as a lead slips through my fingers.
"Nothing, just curious."
"Sorry, I never saw the movie, so I wouldn't know."
"The movie?" I reply.
"Yeah, wasn't the Toy Man a movie or something? Maybe a TV show?"
"Why do you say that?"
"I don't think Chris said anything about an urban legend, but I think he mentioned something about seeing the Toy Man. I thought maybe his auntie took him."
"Seeing the Toy Man. And what did he say about the movie?"
"I guess he was some kind of black Santa Claus. He drove a white Cadillac and gave presents to good kids.
You know how kids get obsessed with a movie and stop thinking it's real."
Jesus Christ. I have to take a deep breath to collect my thoughts. I don't even know where to begin with telling him that the Toy Man wasn't a movie, but an actual man his son may have spoken to, who may have killed him.
"Let's talk later. I gotta check on something." Corman is leaning against the fence, watching the exchange. He can read my reaction on my face.
"So I guess Chris Bostrom heard about the Toy Man, too?" I nod. He told his father something about seeing him.
Well, Dad never told me, Corman replies, a bit defensively.
His father thought it was a movie.
Corman shakes his head and stares at the ground. Do you know why his dad took so long to tell me Chris was missing?
You've given me a lot of reasons.
When I met with him, his eyes were bloodshot and he was coming down from something. I don't know if he has any idea what his son was up to, or what he thinks he saw, or who he knew.
I hold up three fingers. Three kids. Three Toy Man sightings.
I'm sure they all know who Magneto is, too. That's not even a correlation. It's a local folk story that drug dealers tell their little brothers and sisters to keep them in line.
Corman waves off the idea.
If you find him, let me know. I've gone down every alley, every side street. There's no Toy Man waiting around the corner.
After he leaves, I take a seat on the bench facing the mural and zoom in to the image of it on my phone. There's so much detail in the blood and the way the eyes gaze into you. It's not the kind of thing a teenager spray paints because it's fun. It's the kind of thing they do to cope with something that's haunting them. I don't get the feeling that the artist heard about the Toy Man. I sense that he encountered him, the artist's graffiti almost a kind of therapy. I zoom in on the lower right-hand corner of the image and notice a signature, D. Rez. I'll bet anything he has a story to tell. Maybe it's how he and his buddies made up this crazy urban legend 10 years ago. Maybe it's what my gut is telling me. My gut. I can't ignore it. I have to either disprove or confirm it. I call Corman's cell phone, even though I can see him from here as he gets into his car.
Yeah?
Can you give me the number of someone in the gang unit, whoever works on graffiti?
I can hear him groan. If it will make you go away, you want to talk to Marcus Grenier. Just call LAPD direct.
Thank you.
And do me a favor. Don't tell him I told you to call him.
10 minutes later, a rather laconic-sounding man answers the phone.
Grenier speaking.
I was told you were the one I could call and ask about graffiti.
You want OCS, Operation Clean Sweep. They'll help you clean it up.
No, I'm trying to find out the identity of a tagger, I reply.
If you tell me you're from an art gallery, I'm going to punch you through this fucking phone. We don't need to encourage the little fuckers.
What if I was a rival and wanted to give him a beatdown for tagging my art?
I'd say you're full of shit, but I like your ideas anyway. Some asshole get your building?
Basically.
Well, I can give you a name if you want to contact a lawyer to sue him.
Haha.
Or I can put you in touch with the prosecutor's office if they're making a case. What's the tag?
D period R-E-Z.
1 second.
I can hear a typing coming from his end of the phone.
You want the good news or the bad news?
Actually, it's all good news.
Artis Isaacs is currently in county lockup, awaiting trial for armed robbery. Now I feel good. This story has a happy ending.
Can you give me a case number?
What? You're still not happy? This is his third felony. He'll probably actually do real time this go-around. Fine, have at him. Got a pen?
Chapter 22. Confabulation. A day later, I'm sitting on a tiny metal stool bolted to the floor, designed for minimal comfort. Adjacent to me on the other side of the glass, a white guy, with an expletive neck tattoo that will probably make running for future public office difficult, is covering the mouthpiece of his phone as he yells at his girlfriend over some domestic issue while trying not to raise the ire of the guards. He seems like a real classy guy. I have no idea what to expect with Artis. His rap sheet isn't exactly encouraging. Although his juvenile records are sealed, the fact that his first adult charge was at 16 tells me that filing cabinet was full.
a foster kid whose mother was in and out of jail and apparently bouncing from pimp to pimp, Artis never had a real good go at life. He did his first county jail time as an adult for intent to sell. His latest endeavor was trying to rob an Uber driver after using a stolen phone to call him. I take some solace that, according to his sheet, he never actually hurt anyone. But all that means is they never charged him for it. The cold, hard truth about career criminals is that they get charged for less than 10% of the crimes they commit. I keep that in mind whenever I read an All This Guy Did Was headline on a blog. On the other hand, our justice system is based on what we can prove and not what we suspect, and I'm not sure if there's a better alternative unless we want to be a police state. I requested a meeting with Artis, telling him I was a reporter and making sure to put $50 in his account at the jail so he can buy snacks and other things we take for granted on the outside. When he's escorted in, the first thing I notice is a pair of gray, almost silver eyes spotting me from the far side of the room. He lifts his chin slightly and flashes a grin. A guard points him to the seat opposite me. Artis drops down and picks up the phone.
My new favorite person! Your donation to the Artis Rehabilitation Fund is much appreciated.
Happy to help, I reply. Do I get to deduct that from my taxes along with the 3 hours I spend in the waiting room?
Sorry about that. I'll have my people get you through faster next time.
I wasn't sure what I was expecting, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't the happy-go-lucky young man sitting in front of me. Thanks. I'm not sure how much small talk to make. I'm bad at it, even when I'm not talking to guys waiting to find out if they're going to be spending the next several Christmases behind bars.
So are you here to find out my side of the story?
He thinks I'm here about the Uber thing.
Nope.
Ready to launch into some rehearsed alibi, his expression changes as soon as he realizes I said I wasn't interested.
Wait, aren't you the reporter that wanted to get my side on that?
That was a lie, I reply.
Then what the fuck are you here for? If you're the prosecutor, I can have this case thrown out.
I'm not a lawyer. I take the photo of his mural out of my folder. I wanted to ask you about this. He glances at it for a second, then turns his eyes on me.
I don't know who D-Rez is. He's obviously a very talented young man. If you're interested in an exhibition of his work, I might be able to put you in contact with him.
Well, I'll put $50 into D-Rez's canteen account if he can answer some questions for me.
Artis thinks this over.
You know what? D-Rez might be available. Hold on.
He makes a motion of getting up and sitting back down.
How might I help you?
Artis loves to play the clown. It's probably a skill he had to develop as he got bounced around from home to home, and later, facility to facility. Well, Mr. D-Rez, let's talk about the toy man. His expression goes cold. The perpetual smile on his cheekbones fades away. For a moment, I see a scared kid.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I point to the words Toy Man at the top of the mural. It says it right here. And if I'm not mistaken, that's the same paint you used for the rest of the painting. He's trying to figure me out, wondering why I'm really here. I want to know the story, I explain.
I don't know anything about it. It's just something kids used to talk about, that's all.
His reply is almost robotic. Did you ever meet him? He takes way too long to give me an answer to convince me otherwise.
Meet him? He's not real. He's like Freddy Krueger. How do you meet him? Unless it's the actor or some shit like that.
You hear about the killer in Montana? The one that might set a new record for kills? He nods slowly.
I may have seen something on the news. Big, scary redneck dude.
That's the one. I met him.
How did that go?
He almost killed me. I don't like talking about it.
Did people believe you?
Here we go. I think I understand his reticence. Eventually, the problem at first was nobody believed he was real. I had to dig up bodies. Lots of bodies.
I can still see the pale faces of the young women I found rotting in shallow graves. I know what it's like when nobody believes you. He shakes his head.
I don't know what you're talking about. I got sliced up by some gang kids.